is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We are obviously concerned about potential for cholera, measles, and malaria outbreaks in the region. In addition, Tigray region is also located in the meningitis belt, and it is at the risk of yellow fever outbreaks.
That was WHO spokesman Tariq Jasarvik on the potential health problems in Ethiopia's Tigray region due to lack of access by aid organizations. Details coming up. Also, pro-democracy protesters are demanding immediate political reform in Eswatini. 10 people have been killed overnight in DRC's eastern city of Beni. And the clock is ticking for South Africa's former president Jacob Zuma to start his prison sentence. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. More than 800 people in Uganda's capital Kampala are believed to have received a fake COVID-19 jab in the months of May and June. According to records, some of the recipients have already died during the second COVID-19 wave to strike the country. Katrin Nambi reports from Kampala.
Acting on a tip-off from local council authorities in the Kampala suburb of Nakawa, the Uganda State House Health Monitoring Unit confiscated about 100 suspicious vials of the COVID-19 vaccine. According to Uganda National Medical Stores, the batch numbers on the suspected vaccines do not match those that were imported under the COVAX facility early this year. The vials also have tampered seals and tops, an indication that they could have been refilled in a suspicious manner. During interrogations, officials established that it is mostly staff members of corporate institutions that have fallen for the scheme of the suspected fraudsters. Dr. Walen Namara is the head of the State House Health Monitoring Unit.
In other words, people thought it was an easier way out of getting a vaccine. Instead of lining up in established institutional centers that we had put there as government, they opted to use private means, and the private means happened not to be the correct means.
According to Namara, two suspects have been arrested over the scam, while the hunt for those still at large continues.
They were not health workers. They did not belong to any health institution. They were not authorized by the Ministry of Health. There is one who was calling himself a doctor, and he actually is a school dropout of statistics. When we questioned them, they were not able to answer our questions fully. We got suspicious, and we asked the police to do their work, so they are with the police helping further.
He says the contents of the vials have been handed over to the government analytical laboratory for further scrutiny.
Investigating what fluid was contained in these vials, we are hopeful that it was water for injection or normal saline, because that would make sense, in which case people would not be in danger, except that they would not have got a vaccine.
Although in Uganda the vaccination is free of charge, the suspected fraudsters were charging between $30 to $60 to administer the fake vaccine to each individual. It is suspected that jabs could be the reason behind high rates of COVID-19 deaths among Ugandans who reportedly received the vaccinations for the coronavirus. Namara says the individuals who purportedly got the phony vaccines will be called upon to aid investigations and also retake the vaccines once it is established that the jabs they received are fake. This comes as a number of Ugandans are rushing to get vaccinated against COVID-19 in the wake of the second deadly wave that has led to increased fatalities and hospital admissions. Uganda, which received about 170,000 new doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine early this month, is mainly focusing on vaccinating those requiring a second jab. Uganda, like many African countries, is still lagging behind on the World Health Organization's vaccination targets for the population. Experts are warning that Uganda will soon slip into a third wave of COVID-19 outbreak. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
And in related news, the World Health Organization has expressed concern after Uganda approved a locally made herbal treatment for COVID-19 amid a third wave of cases. The substance is not approved by the WHO for COVID-19 treatment, but Ugandan pharmacists say they have little choice because drugs authorized for emergency use in developed countries are not available. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Uganda's Drug Authority revealed Tuesday it had approved a herbal medicine known as Covidex to treat symptoms of viral infections, even though it has not been reviewed by the World Health Organization. Dr. David Nahamia, Executive Director of Uganda's Drug Authority, said it had approved the herbal treatment after a two-week scientific evaluation of its safety and efficacy.
Covidex has been notified to be sold in licensed drug outlets for supportive treatment in management of viral infections, but not as a cure of COVID-19.
The WHO consulted researchers from nine African countries, including Uganda, in March about the use of traditional medicine to treat COVID-19, the condition caused by the coronavirus. Dr. Solomon Okware of the WHO's Uganda office says Covidex isn't among the traditional medicines that was evaluated.
WHO has not received any information about this product.
Dr. Nahamia reassured Ugandans that the manufacturer, Jenna Herbals Uganda, has increased production and the herb will be available for all who need it under medical supervision. He added that the approval is based on initial assessments, published literature, and safety studies conducted by the innovator.
The product has been formulated from herbal plants that have been traditionally used are yet symptoms of several diseases. National Drug Authority has advised the manufacturer to conduct clinical trials, which are at the highest level of evidence, to ascertain any claims of treatment.
Dr. Warren says in collaboration with the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the WHO developed master and generic protocols to provide guidance to members for developing clinical trials to assess claims of effective treatment for COVID-19.
Many plants and substances are being proposed without the minimum requirements and evidence of quality, safety, and efficacy. The use of products to treat COVID-19, which have not yet been robustly investigated, can be harmful if the due process is not followed.
Dr. Samuel Opio, the secretary of the Pharmaceutical Society Uganda, says while there are concerns of misuse of Covidex by the public, its approval is a positive step.
Whatever is currently being approved like emergency use in the U.S. are not available in Uganda. So the issue of lack of treatment, the issue of inaccessibility to even what is approved for emergency use means that we need to also look for local solutions to the global challenges. And herbal treatment is one area.
Uganda recently received 175,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine, but is only inoculating frontline workers with just 856,025 people vaccinated in the country. Many members of the public have resorted to using Covidex to treat COVID-19 symptoms. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
The clock is ticking for South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma. 2 days ago, the country's constitutional court sentenced him to 15 months in jail for refusing to testify at a commission of inquiry into corruption. Within the next 3 days, according to the court, 79-year-old Zuma must begin serving the term at a prison in either Johannesburg or his home province of KwaZulu-Natal. The so-called State Capture Commission was established to investigate the looting of state enterprises of billions of dollars when Zuma was president between 2009 and 2018. Darren Taylor has more.
For many years, Zuma fought apartheid by leading intelligence operations for the African National Congress's armed wing, Umkhonto we Sizwe, otherwise known as MK and Spear of the Nation.
We do not want President Zuma to be arrested and to be imprisoned.
Zuma says he's being persecuted by the man who ousted him in late 2017 to become South Africa's current leader, Cyril Ramaphosa. Uniformed MK-MVA members have gathered outside Zuma's home in the town of Nkandla. Some say if Zuma, who has denied any wrongdoing, decides not to go to jail, they won't let anyone take him there by force. Niao says their words are not threats, but to show their patron he isn't alone.
Obviously, there's going to be protest, and obviously we're going to utilize our constitutional right of freedom of speech. Nkontubisi Military Veterans Association also issued a media statement calling on all our members to stand up to protest against this, obviously within the parameters of the law and the undermining of the rights, the legitimate rights of one of our most important citizens, President Zuma.
But Zuma's supporters have often not acted within the law. After he accused the commission's head, Raymond Zondo, of being an apartheid collaborator, the judge and his family were threatened with death. Photos of their home and its address were published on social media. Bullets were fired through a window. An emotional Zondo, who'd asked the court to jail Zuma for 2 years, told the News 24 channel he took no triumph in the finding against the former president.
The situation has been difficult for many people within the commission with all of these attacks. In the legal team, the investigation team, so it has not just been me. Do I regret taking this job? Not at all. If I was asked to do it again, I would do it again.
MK veteran Mac Maharaj was Zuma's spokesman during his presidency. When the media and opposition parties were linking his boss to corruption, Maharaj defended him vigorously. Now, he says, Zuma misguided him and abused his and the nation's trust. Maharaj hopes Zuma's imprisonment closes the chapter of government-driven corruption in South Africa.
It's also a very sad moment for me. The former president chose to challenge the authority and the credibility of our apex court and to place himself above the Constitution. It is sad because he has played an important role in our liberation struggle and was involved in negotiating our path from apartheid to democracy.
He says Zuma shouldn't be surprised by the court's finding.
He went down a slippery slope to the point where he began to believe in himself and placed himself above the law. I think he has chosen this path as a way to shift attention from the corruption in which he has been involved and to hold the banner of a victim and a martyr.
Maharaj says it's tragic that a self-interested Zuma's spending the last years of his life betraying the very principles that he once risked his life for. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
UN aid agencies warn of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in northern Ethiopia's battle-scarred Tigray region if they are prevented from delivering life-saving assistance to this stricken area. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The Ethiopian government's tenuous unilateral ceasefire in Tigray after 8 months of conflict has not got off to a good start. The UN Refugee Agency reports the electrical power and phone networks in its offices in the capital, Mekele, are not functioning, hampering its ability to deliver humanitarian aid. The UN Children's Fund has condemned the pillaging of its video equipment Monday by members of the Ethiopian National Defense Forces, warning 140,000 acutely malnourished children were at risk of dying without urgent nutritional treatment. The World Food Program is demanding full access to Tigray to deliver life-saving food assistance to millions of hungry people. Among them, it says, are 500,000 children, women, and men who face starvation over the coming months. The World Health Organization reports the region's health system has collapsed. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says WHO can do little to help the beleaguered population because access to the area is extremely limited.
We are obviously concerned about potential for cholera, measles, and malaria outbreaks in the region. In addition, Tigray region is also located in the meningitis belt, and it is at the risk of yellow fever outbreaks. People are also at risk of death from lack of access to health services to treat any other diseases that may have.
Despite the ceasefire, fighting continues in Tigray. Jazarevich says WHO is taking measures to strengthen the security and well-being of its staff. He says efforts to provide essential health care is ongoing where it is possible to do so. However, he adds, what WHO staff can do does not approach the enormity of the needs.
Now, with hospitals that are barely functioning, people being displaced, and the looming famine, the risk of communicable and vaccine-preventable diseases spreading due to the lack of food, clean water, safe shelter, and access to healthcare is very real. And all these factors combined are literally a recipe for larger epidemics.
WHO reports an estimated 3.5 million people are at risk of cholera. It says 6 million people are vulnerable to malaria, especially malnourished children. It says they are at particular risk of dying from this deadly vector-borne disease. An oral cholera vaccine campaign targeting 2 million people, which began on June 12th, was only able to reach 50% of the targeted population. WHO reports this was due to the conflict and difficulty in reaching the region's widely spread population by road. The agency reports attacks on healthcare, the looting and destruction of cold chain, the system used for storing vaccines correctly, and the general dangers posed by the warring parties has had a harmful impact on this life-saving operation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Pro-democracy protesters are demanding immediate political reforms in Eswatini. The country has long stifled dissent and pro-democracy movements, with political parties banned since 1973. The French news agency AFP reports the government has imposed a dusk-to-dawn curfew, internet access is limited, and shops and banks are closed. Troops have been deployed to control the angry pro-democracy crowd. Activists say 8 people have been killed and dozens injured. Neighboring South Africa has issued an urgent call for Eswatini authorities to move away from autocracy. The U.S. State Department called on officials to exercise restraint and allow peaceful protests. Eswatini, formerly known as Swaziland, is Africa's last absolute monarchy. It's led by King Maswati III, who names government ministers and controls the parliament. Somalia's opposition politicians and the public have welcomed a deal to hold delayed indirect presidential elections in October, with lawmakers chosen in July and August. But analysts note unrest and terrorist attacks are still a risk. Mohamed Kayi reports from Mogadishu.
Somalia's opposition politicians welcomed the new election schedule, reached Tuesday in Mogadishu, after a meeting of the federal and state leaders. Opposition lawmaker Mohamed Hassan Idris says they are looking forward to a quick implementation to avoid any further delays and unrests.
So far, we have no concerns. It's on a very welcoming stage. The schedule has been agreed by the leaders and the electoral committees, both from the federal and the member state levels, are present in Mogadishu. We are in an election mood. It's a kicking process that will get into some stage that will need to be discussed again by the leaders. We hope they continue to solve any likely obstacle that might come on their way prior the process.
Somalia's indirect election was to take place in February, but the process was stalled over opposition concerns about free elections. They accused President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, known as Farmajo, of stacking poll committees with his allies. Farmajo denied the allegations but raised international eyebrows in April after he signed into a law a 2-year extension of terms in office. The move sparked days of street clashes in April in Mogadishu between split loyalty security forces, renewing fears of a return to clan violence. under international pressure, Farmajo nullified the extension and returned to talks with the opposition for holding elections. The deal reached Tuesday was largely applauded by Mogadishu residents, like 27-year-old university student Hassan Ahmed. He says he's happy and excited about the new election schedule. They were worried about the previous timeline, says Ahmed, and the disagreements between the leadership of the federal government and the regional states. The indirect elections will begin in July, with delegates chosen by clans selecting members of the lower house of parliament. State governments will select senators beginning in August. The chosen lawmakers will then vote for the next president on October 10th. Despite the breakthrough, there is still a threat from Al-Shabaab militants, says independent security analyst Tahir Koro.
Al-Shabaab is trying to disrupt the Somali election process through suicide bombings and IED attacks, mainly in the venues of the process across regions. However, it's important or very significant to note that the democratic process will attract high security alert both from Somali security agencies and international peacekeeping partners such as AMISOM. It's worth remembering that the training and capacity building for Somali security agencies have been improving in recent years, while Al-Shabaab have been decreasing.
The U.S. Embassy in Somalia urged continued constructive dialogue among Somali leaders to achieve a peaceful and transparent elections. Somalia originally planned to hold direct elections with one person, one vote, which would have been the first in decades. But the plan was scrapped in September due to a lack of infrastructure and concerns about security. Mohamed Kaye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
So far, we have no concerns. It's on a very welcoming stage. The schedule has been agreed by the leaders and the electoral committees, both from the federal and the member state levels, are present in Mogadishu. We are in an election mood. It's a kicking process that will get into some stage that will need to be discussed again by the leaders. We hope they continue to solve any likely obstacle that might come on their way prior to the process.
Haddana ku faraxsanahay in la soo saaray jadwal fadhiya oo lagu xisaabtami karo.
Al-Shabaab is trying to disrupt the Somali election process through suicide bombings and IED attacks, mainly in the venues of the process across regions. However, it's important or very significant to note that the democratic process will attract high security alert both from Somali security agencies and international peacekeeping partners such as AMISOM. It's worth remembering that the training and capacity building for Somali security agencies have been improving in recent years, while Al-Shabaab have been decreasing.
Hundreds of people took to the streets of Beni today to protest against the Democratic Republic of Congo government's failure to protect the eastern city. 10 people were killed overnight. The Islamist militia group, the Allied Democratic Forces, ADF, is suspected. According to a Reuters report, the attack came 4 days after the city was hit by 2 blasts, which officials also blame on the ADF. According to a tally compiled by DRC's Catholic Church, the ADF has been responsible for at least 6,000 deaths in the country's east since 2013. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.